Hello and welcome to the Better Human podcast, presented by me, Adam Wagner. I'm a human rights barrister, that's a lawyer, and this podcast is all about human rights. I've got three things that I want this podcast to do. Discuss the most important human rights issues of the day, not shying away from the difficult and controversial ones. Explain important concepts, no jargon if we can avoid it. And thirdly, answer the key question. How can human rights make us better, as individuals and as a society? The podcast is kindly supported by Goldsmiths Law and their pioneering new LLB Law undergraduate course taught in London. Goldsmiths has open days on Saturday the 5th of October and Wednesday the 6th of November, where you can meet their law academics and find out more about studying their law program. You can get involved in the podcast, and I really am keen for people to feedback and to propose questions and comments. And please do follow Be Human Podcast on Twitter or email me at adam@betterhumanpodcast.com. If you want to support the podcast and make sure that we can carry on discussing the most important human rights issues of the day, please do contribute through our Patreon, which is patreon.com/betterhuman. That's patreon.com/betterhuman. And if 100 people give $5 a month, which is about £4, you'll support the podcast running fortnightly for certainly covering the costs. And if you want to sponsor an episode, if you or your business wants to get a message in to an episode, you can email sponsor@betterhumanpodcast.com. Today's topic is freedom of expression and human rights. The right to free speech is the lifeblood of democracy. It's fundamentally important and has been at the heart of every important rights law for hundreds of years. But today, mainly because of the rise of social media and the fact that we are all now, out of the blue almost, speaking all the time to very large groups of people, has created an enormous clash of rights. People saying that they're being harmed by particular kinds of speech versus others saying that their right to free speech is being curtailed. What's the right answer? Well, we've got an absolutely brilliant guest to discuss that, Jody Ginsburg, who is the CEO of Index on Censorship, which is a nonprofit that campaigns for free expression worldwide and publishes work by censored authors and artists. Jody is also a journalist. She was previously foreign correspondent and the UK bureau chief for Reuters. She remains a regular media commentator on free expression issues, and she also sits on the council of the Global Free Expression Network, IFEX, and the board of trustees for the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. A fun fact about Jody is that she always wanted to be a journalist, and as a child she'd make her friends play what she called the news, which was then performed to long-suffering parents. That must have been, as a long-suffering parent, that must have been really fun for them. She dreamed of being a foreign correspondent to tell stories that were not being heard. So welcome, Jody.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining the podcast. First thing I wanted to ask you is just to tell us a bit about Index on Censorship, which I think is an amazing organization. But tell us why, tell the listeners why they should also think it's an amazing organization.
Index on Censorship is nearly 50 years old now. It was established back in the 1970s as a way to give back voice to dissidents and others in places like the Soviet Union who were being censored, to let them tell their own stories. So we have, for the past nearly, as I say, 50 years, been publishing the work of individuals like Vaclav Havel, Nadine Gordimer, and others writing about censorship and the effect of censorship. And in addition to that, we campaign on freedom of expression issues across all sectors. So we look at media freedom, we look at academic freedom. Increasingly, we're looking at online speech and restrictions online, and thinking about the effect of censorship in the arts.
Great. And today we were going to talk about free expression. And this is always a hot human rights issue. It has been turbocharged since millions and billions of people became, all of us, almost overnight, online publishers of speech, Whereas before, if you wanted to get in front of a lot of people, you would have to be in a newspaper or on TV or stand in front of a crowd. And the landscape's completely changed. So we thought it'd be good to have a conversation which looks back on the history of freedom of expression, looks at the current protections, and then we'll talk about some of the issues which arise, which affect pretty much everybody in modern society. And it's one of those rights which a lot everybody's affected by, but people don't understand very well. So let's start by looking at where our free right to free expression comes from. How did it evolve?
Well, let me start by saying you're right to say that we're really thinking about free expression in a way that we've never had to do before, because so many more of us are able to put our freedom of expression in a form where it can be reviewed, held up to scrutiny. And in the past, as we've said, that's been the purview of perhaps writers, academics, intellectuals. And now anybody can say whatever they like all of the time, supposedly. And that's creating huge challenges, but also massive opportunities. So in the past, I think a lot of the way in which we've thought about rights, if you like, was actually much more about restrictions. So states sought to restrict what could be said for the safety of the state or the safety of the religious grouping that was perhaps in charge. So if you think most of the laws and norms that we had around speech in the early years of democracies evolving was about restrictions, about what people would say because that threatened the safety of the state or the religious grouping. If you think about individuals like Galileo. So we ended up with these what we would call blasphemy laws. So insulting religions, saying anything that wasn't the religious line.
Yeah, and Galileo was in trouble for saying the earth revolved around the sun.
Exactly.
Which was a problem for the Pope.
Yes, and so nowadays you would think it seems utterly ridiculous that something that we have now agreed as scientific provable fact would be so heretical that somebody ought to be killed for it, punished for it. Seems ridiculous now, but that continues to be the case in many countries, that if you criticize a religion or do anything that is not sanctioned by your religious body, you may be punished for it, including with death. But increasingly over the years, what has evolved are protections for freedom of expression. So the right, enshrining your right to be able to criticize the status quo, to challenge the status quo. And obviously, most famously, that's enshrined in the First Amendment in the United States.
Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. That's pretty simple.
It's very simple and essentially has made free expression one of the founding principles of the United States. And I'm sure we'll come on to talk about this. That doesn't mean actually in practice that you can say whatever you like in the United States. Although I know a lot of people think that's the case, there are still restrictions and let's come on and talk about those. But that is an interesting amendment or an interesting element of the Constitution, because what it essentially says is the state cannot pass laws pretty much that restrict freedom of expression. In other words, you as a citizen can express your opinion freely. If we come on and think about where freedom of expression is protected in a universal context, you would look at something like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19, which also protects freedom of expression.
Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. So I suppose going back to in modern times, we start after the Second World War with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was the pretty much the whole world, with exceptions, coming together and agreeing a set of principles, effectively. They don't bind states in the sense that you can't go to a court and enforce them necessarily, and certainly not at the time. But we have Article 19, which says everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression.
And again, fairly simple, basic standard through which we derive rights in the UK and internationally to protect our freedom of expression. Over time, the laws that have derived, or if you like, the standards that have derived from principles like Article 19 have become more qualified. Yeah. So if you look at the European Convention on Human Rights, which establishes a similar set of principles for European Union countries and some countries beyond, then you start to get into the realm of more qualifications. So Article 10, which is the element that protects free expression in the European Convention, does have more carve-outs in terms of what states can reasonably restrict.
Yeah, so I'll read out the relevant bits of Article 10. So it has sort of two sides to it. It's like if you imagine it like scales. And on the one side of the scales is everyone has the right to freedom of expression. This right shall include freedom to hold opinions and to receive and impart information and ideas without interference by a public authority. So that's not dissimilar to the restriction on states abridging freedom of speech. But then it has the other side of the scales, the exercise of these freedoms, since it carries with it duties and responsibilities, may be subject to such restrictions or penalties as are prescribed by law and are necessary in a democratic society. And then it goes on to list a number of different ways in which the restrictions can work. If they include this, for example, the protection of morals or the reputation and rights of others, that sort of defamation law. So it is a kind of shopping list of potential restrictions.
And it's left up to then the states to interpret that as they see fit. And that's where you get into this much more grey area, a much more contentious area about what we consider to be reasonable restrictions.
Yeah, and I suppose the other important thing to understand about the European Convention, which we signed up to as a state, as the UK in 1953, is that from a couple of decades later, you could, if your rights were being breached by the state, say a hospital or a local government or a politician, you could take that to a court in Strasbourg and get those enforced, and then the UK has agreed to abide by that. And that was the position, that was where we got our human rights from until 1998. And then something changed.
So in 1998, we introduced the Human Rights Act, which essentially ported many of the agreements that we had made and signed up to in part of the European Convention, but brought them into UK law. So one of the interesting conversations to be had now as we're thinking about what happens as we leave Europe is what happens to the Human Rights Act and the importance of maintaining our commitment to universal human rights, which includes things like freedom of expression.
Yeah, so when we leave the European Union, we lose the... And this is another instrument that, you know, and it's no surprise people get confused by all of this, but the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, which also protects freedom of expression. But we don't lose the European Convention because that's a separate treaty and it's unaffected. It's loosely connected to the EU and that new EU members have to sign up to it, but it's not the same. And if we Brexit, we won't leave that. And we also keep the Human Rights Act, which brought these rights into our law, into our local laws. But we've got where we end up with is this heavily qualified right to freedom of expression, which is qualified by, you know, public morals, the reputation of others, etc. So that's where we end up.
Yes, that's right. And I think it's really important that people do understand that, because I think often there's confusion, there's huge confusion, and particularly because now we are able to communicate in so many different ways and so publicly to so many people. There is a great deal of confusion about what can and can't be said and what can legitimately be restricted by law and what is being restricted, for example, simply through terms of service that a social media platform might have, or indeed by kind of social norms, if you like. So I think it's really important to understand that, particularly as we're in discussions about, you know, we've heard talk about people ripping up the Human Rights Act. So it's really, I think, important that people understand what is currently protected in a way that is really positive for everybody's rights.
Yeah. And while we're on the positive side, and one thing I really want to get out of this podcast is thinking about the values and principles behind all these technical laws and protections. And I suppose I should have asked this question at the beginning. Why have free speech? What's the point of it?
Freedom of expression, to me, and not just to me, actually, the United Nations have even talked about this, is really a bedrock freedom. It's a fundamental freedom. If you think about it, without the ability to speak freely, how do we advocate for the other rights? So how do we advocate for the right to love and marry whomever we choose, or to practice our religion or our freedom from religion, or to advocate for political rights? So without freedom of expression, it is impossible to do those things. And if you think about all social movements over history have relied on the ability of individuals to speak openly about how they want things to change.
And I suppose that all autocratic or non-democratic governments, the first thing they've done is shut down newspapers, shut down free expression, prosecute people for saying the wrong thing being the thing which attacks them.
Limits on speech and expression are always the hallmarks or the indicators of a regime that is becoming less democratic or is authoritarian. So as we are looking at the world today, we're increasingly seeing a number of supposedly democratic countries taking on authoritarian characteristics. And one of the first indicators of that being the case is they target individuals for their expression. So if you think about countries like Turkey, for example, where hundreds of journalists are in jail, those kinds of actions are absolutely typical of authoritarian regimes.
And just to boil it down, why?
Because controlling the narrative is one way that you can control the people. You control dissent by controlling the narrative, and that means taking control, for example, of the newspapers, control of the broadcasters, control now of the internet. So increasingly seeing, for example, countries resorting to simply turning off the internet, to turning off communications mechanisms when they're concerned about unrest amongst the people, or indeed that people are voicing opinions that do not match the status quo. And if you think about it, that's very much relates back to the Galileo motivation, right? The Galileo motivation was, this guy is saying something that ultimately challenges the bedrock of society and the power structures that exist, so he must be quietened. And that continues to be the view of authoritarian societies. The people who say things that challenge the status quo, who want something different, who want women to have the right to vote, who want certain religious minorities to have more rights, those authoritarian regimes typically handle those demands for change by shutting down the means through which those people advocate for change. In other words, their speech.
So let's zoom into the UK, which is a pretty good country for free speech. Is that fair to say?
It is a good country for free speech. And I think one of the key things is that we should never take those freedoms for granted. They're very hard won, but quite easily lost, because we sort of are lulled into this idea that, well, if you restrict in this area, then that will be okay. And you often end up then finding you've opened the door to far greater restrictions. But yes, of course, largely we have a free and vibrant press. We are able to freely express ourselves largely, but we do have some restrictions about what can be said.
Yeah. And those restrictions are growing in the age of the internet. Is that fair to say?
It's absolutely fair to say that they're growing in the age of the internet, because policymakers, lawmakers are looking at ways to cope with some of the negative aspects that have been the natural corollary of lots of people being able to express their opinions to a wide range.
So if we're going to look at the laws which potentially restrict free speech, let's start with the Communications Act, because that's the one that I dislike the most. And I'm being very subjective here. But what that does is it prevents people sending a message and I'm quoting, by means of a public electronic communications network that is grossly offensive or of an indecent, obscene and menacing character. So what does that law mean?
So that law is really an updated version of a much older law that was really intended actually to deal with what I would call heavy breathers. So I know these days we don't use the phone very much, but in the olden days, people would call up and you would have an operator who would place your call. And those operators would often be on the receiving end of menacing communications. In other words, people calling them up and saying obscene things or offensive things about their person, lewd sexual innuendo and so on. And so really it existed to protect those individuals against that kind of behavior. And in the modern age, it was expanded to include electronic communications, in other words, email. So somebody sending you something directly grossly offensive. So if I sent something to you, Adam, with rude pictures in it or so on, it could be prosecuted under this act. But of course, what it didn't take into account was social media.
No. So the clue's in the date, right? 2003.
2003. So well before, I think Facebook's only been around for 15 years. So predates even Facebook's establishment. What it didn't account for, that act is really about person to person. So me harassing effectively you with unwanted communication. Doesn't take into account the idea that we might be able to post messages that lots of people can see, including people whom you never thought might see it or it be intended for. So in other words, I could post a message that's really intended for my mates where I make an extremely off-color joke or remark that you might find offensive or grossly offensive, but I didn't think or intend for you to see it. You could still be prosecuted, and people are, under this element of the Communications Act.
And back in 2003, when you said viral, it meant that you were suffering from a disease, and there wasn't this concept, or there probably wasn't even the idea that we could have that exchange where I post a stupid message on a WhatsApp group with four of my friends, and one of my friends screen grabs it and sends it to another friend, who then puts it on his Facebook profile, and which is then put on Twitter, and then it ends up being seen by millions of people within about, well, it could be a few minutes in today's world. And that is a fundamentally materially different scenario to me sending you a grossly offensive email.
Yes, because one is targeted, right? One is me deliberately trying to cause you essentially harm or distress. And the other is much more about something that may well be inadvertent. So you may say or do something that I would consider offensive, but many other people might see as just simply funny. And that has meant that increasing numbers of people have been caught in the net for making off-color jokes about getting frustrated because the airport is not open, and making jokes about wanting to blow it up. Or
remember that the Twitter joke trial, as I think it was ended up being called, where exactly as you described, somebody on Twitter said, "I'm going to, if Nottingham Airport doesn't sort itself out, I'm gonna blow it up," and it was a joke. And he was prosecuted under the section 127 of the Communications Act as a grossly offensive, malicious, a menacing message, which was effectively a terrorist threat. And it went to appeal, and the judges couldn't decide what the answer was, so it had to go to another appeal. And eventually, he succeeded on free expression grounds, but not under the Human Rights Act. Actually, he succeeded under the common law, which is something we haven't spoken about, but in effect is the same. And it goes back before the Human Rights Act.
But there are, and that's right, and I'm pleased by that judgment. But if you think about it, in a sort of rational democracy, it should be possible to look at those such tweets and be able to say, quite easily that should never have come to court, because it was quite evident that was a joke, should have been quite evident. And so the fact that it got as far as it did is concerning. And there have been cases where people have been successfully prosecuted for making off-color jokes on Twitter or social media. So the most recent example would be the case of a YouTuber who goes by the name of Count Dankula, who shared with his followers a social media video of him teaching his girlfriend's dog to do a Nazi salute. And he was also found guilty under communications law of gross offence. Now, that, I think, brings us on to questions about how people are targeting speech, because Communications Act and the Malicious Communications Act, which does similar things, are one way of restricting speech. But they're not the only mechanism for restricting speech. And we also have speech restrictions related to race and religion and so-called protected characteristics. So that's contained in the Racial and Religious Hatred Act, for example. There's also restrictions around expression that sit within the Public Order Act, for example. And one of the interesting
the Public Order Act, we're talking about stirring up racial or religious or some other kind of hatred based on what are called protected characteristics. So if you are gay or you are black or you are Christian and someone is trying to stir up hatred against you, they can be caught by that law.
Yes, that's right. And that they're called the sort of so-called stirring up offences. But when we talk about hate speech in the UK, I think there's often a misconception that there's something called a hate speech law. There isn't a hate speech law. We don't have hate speech laws. We have a number of different laws that contain provisions that allow restriction of speech based on stirring up hate or incitement to hatred. But there aren't so such things as hate speech laws. But what's interesting when we think about something like the Racial and Religious Hatred Act and the Public Order Act, which do contain those provisions to restrict speech on the grounds of hatred, actually some of those considerations are also falling into something like the Communications Act. So if you think of the case of Count Dankula, when the judge was summing up, one of the findings was that it was felt that that involved hatred towards Jews, but the prosecution wasn't under, if you like, traditional hate speech laws. It was under the gross offence laws. And I think that brings us into this question about what do we think are reasonable restrictions? Because gross offence, for example, is hugely subjective, and I think does lead us down a path where people will have their speech unreasonably restricted for making remarks that one section of the population might find offensive but don't cause demonstrable harm.
Yeah, and I think, and let's dig into Count Dankula, because I think the Twitter joke trial is an example of an obvious wrong prosecution. It shouldn't have ever been prosecuted. It was obviously a joke. The CPS didn't understand Twitter, and it was a relatively new medium. And that's a comfortable case. And I think Count Dankula is an uncomfortable case, because here is a guy who puts a video on YouTube of teaching his pug or his girlfriend's pug how to do Nazi salutes while every time he says gas the Jews. And he is probably what you'd describe as an edgy alt-right comedian. I think it's probably fair to say if you look at his output, it sort of skirts the line quite often, as the alt-right people do, between what looks pretty straightforwardly as religious or racial hatred, what might in other circumstances be called comedy. And how do you police those boundaries? That's what's really difficult about that case. Why is that prosecution wrong or right?
So we would argue that the gross offence element of the Communications Act ought to be removed because it is so hugely subjective. And gross offence, let's go back to thinking about Article 10 and the reasonable restrictions. So we at Index on Censorship would argue that really speech only ought to be restricted when there's risk of imminent danger to an individual resulting from that speech.
So that's the kind of lock test, right?
The lock test. It's incitement.
Risk of harm.
Yeah, risk of harm, incitement to violence. But particularly, we have to think about that as, you know, serious harm as opposed to hurt feelings, for example. And this is where we often get into grey areas, because how you define harm becomes crucial in this discussion. But we can, I think, put that to one side in this case.
Let's come back to that.
And come back to that.
Because I think that's an important question.
Because I think the question of harm becomes absolutely pertinent when you're thinking about incitement to hatred, or stirring up hatred. But in that particular case, what I think is problematic is the proving of harm to a particular individual. You can say it is grossly offensive. Of course it is grossly offensive to a very large number of people. But whether or not it has caused harm, I think, is deeply questionable.
And you don't need to prove harm to be convicted. All you need to do under that law is say something that a judge or a jury think are grossly offensive on a public communications network. That's it.
Absolutely. And if you think about gross offence, how do we establish a standard or a norm for that? So what one judge might consider to be grossly offensive may be vastly different to another, and it will change hugely over time also. So these things are very much about the society in which they are being tested.
Yeah, or the moment in that society.
Precisely. So if there's a particularly heightened moment where we are feeling particularly sensitive about the treatment of one community or another, you may tackle the same offence very differently 6 months to 12 months down the line. So I think that is the greatest challenge with this, is that if we are going to restrict people's free expression, and we've talked about why free expression is so important, then I think there has to be a very, very high threshold for proving that your speech has caused some kind of harm that makes it worthy of being restricted. And I think in this case, to me, though I agree that teaching your dog or your girlfriend's dog to do a Nazi salute every time gas is used is offensive, I don't think that's funny, grossly offensive, is that speech that should be restricted? No, I don't think so.
Isn't one of the real issues about this law that Count Dankula highlighted is that people have a very different understanding of what's funny?
Of course. And again, I come back to this question about subjectivity. While gross offence is subjective, comedy is subjective also. So what people find funny, what people laugh at, is widely different. And in fact, interestingly, when you think about the ways in which law has evolved in the UK over time, in many aspects, we have put in carve-outs to protect comedy and satire, to protect the rights of people to say things that may hurt the feelings of others, because we consider the ability to mock, to laugh at as a fundamental,
and to offend
as fundamentally. So I think, so offence is interesting, because I think that really gets to the heart of it. When we get confused about what we do and have the you don't have a right not to be offended. You don't have a right not to be offended. And in fact, that's been considered in a number of courts, including in the European Court, where judges have said in the past, the right to free expression includes the right to shock, offend, or disturb.
And I think that comes out of Handicide in the UK, which was a very interesting case about a little red school book, which I think it was actually decided in the UK's favour. They banned a little red school book that I think had taught children about sex. But what came out, the most important, as sometimes happens with legal cases, even though the person who made the book lost, the principle that came out of it, of this freedom to offend, shock, and disturb being included in, or fundamental to the right to free expression is what kind of comes down the ages, and it's decades old now, that case.
But what's interesting about that is, though we have that ruling that demonstrates quite clearly that freedom, the freedom to offend is protected, if you like, yet we continue to have a crime of gross offence on the books. And that seems to me to send out a very confusing message to people about why and how we should protect freedom of expression. So in other words, when we think about restrictions, we have to think very carefully about why we are restricting the speech. And I come back down to this point where we ought to be thinking about restrictions in terms of where they are causing demonstrable harm, measurable harm. And I think when you start to look at expanding offences so that they include things like offence, what you're not, you don't have to demonstrate harm, you just have to have somebody's opinion that that's offensive to justify quite swinging restrictions on another individual's free speech.
So let's talk about harm. And we've got the something called the harm principle. I mentioned Locke before, and there's also Mill. But there's this idea that free speech is the lifeblood of democracy, and that you must keep it flowing because you don't know what ideas are right or wrong at any given time, as history tells us over and over and over again. See Galileo. And the question then becomes, if you're only going to restrict speech on the basis of its causes harm, how do you define harm?
This, to me, is the absolute crux of what the challenges that we face when talking about the defense of free speech, particularly in the modern world. So you're right. Traditionally, free speech advocates have looked to the defenses of free expression that have come from philosophers and thinkers like John Stuart Mill, who thought about how you should and when you should restrict free speech. And Mill talks about the importance of being able even to say things that are wrong, because then they collide with correct ideas and then they become more exposed. But also talks about instances in which you might think about restricting it. So, for example, standing outside somebody's house and advocating for individuals to be harmed in some way or hurt in some way, or saying, you know, all corn merchants are terrible, while standing outside the corn merchant's house in front of a baying mob could cause an imminent risk of harm. So that's a legitimate reason for restricting it.
Shouting
fire in a crowded theatre is the traditional example given in the US example. So that's famously one of the restrictions that's talked about as being allowed when talking about where the restrictions are placed in the United States, is given as an example. The challenge is in those cases, what Mill and others were talking about was thinking about things as violence. So the idea that if you start to incite people's anger and they're already carrying large sticks, then the likelihood that they then go out and batter the person in the house is highly likely. And so he was thinking much more about sort of direct violence resulting physical violence. But as we have evolved as a society, we've started to think about harm in a different way. So we've become much more understanding of psychological harm, for example. And that, I think, has become a challenge for us as free speech advocates that we don't talk about enough, actually, because people have started to think about harm in a different way. And so when we talk about stirring up offences, for example, we're thinking about whether or not saying negative things, racist speech, anti-Semitic speech, causes harm to an individual or is likely to cause harm to that group because it causes people to think about them or treat them in a different way. Unfortunately, often we have looked to law to try and identify that and measure it in some way, in ways that I think end up negatively restricting speech. That is how we have got to some of these other laws which restrict free expression, because it envisages harm in quite a different way.
And that, as you say, is the crux of the issue. And the way, I mean, in law, if you do something negligent and you cause somebody a psychiatric injury, which is identified by a psychiatrist, so typically PTSD from a road traffic accident, you have to pay that person. You have to pay out for that. That's seen as, that is just as much harm in the law as breaking their arm, as long as you can get the psychiatrist to diagnose it. But what we see with speech is a lot of talk of microaggressions, this kind of, and I don't want to parody it because I think there's some, it's very easy to say, oh, well, that's just, all the snowflake narrative. But there is this point of if you say something which is deeply offensive to somebody's, something about some inherent characteristic of somebody, you might actually cause them psychiatric harm. If it's in public, if it's seen by lots of people, if it's a sort of public shaming. And that seems to be a really difficult question in relation to free speech.
It's a hugely difficult question, and it's hugely difficult for a number of reasons. So the first is the, I suppose, what you might call the burden of proof or the subjectivity of it, because what might be to one person extremely harmful language said once may be to somebody else not considered as such. And so for a court to be able to test whether or not that's actually caused harm is very difficult. So actually, in most of these cases, you don't have to prove that. It's simply enough to be considered to be stirring up hatred towards. You don't have to actually prove that that's had a measurable and damaging effect on an individual, the individual concerned. So that then places a great deal of burden on law enforcement, for example, to be able to assess whether the language is likely to stir up hatred towards a particular group of individuals and potentially place restrictions on that individual that are not reasonable. So if you take the example of a street preacher, for example, so in the UK, individuals are allowed to preach religious texts or religious viewpoints on the street. However, some of the viewpoints expressed when individuals are doing so may also be considered to be, for example, homophobic. And so we have seen cases in which preachers and others have been arrested for example, the Public Order Act, under the stirring up offence, for a stirring up offence, because though they are allowed to preach their religious views, what they're saying is considered to be homophobic or denigrating of another religion or another race. And that's where we come into this clash between whose rights get protected, because we fought very hard for religious freedom to be protected in the UK and for us to be able to express our religious views. So what does the law do in the case where that religious view is essentially outlawed?
Can we talk about gay cake and compelled speech?
Yeah.
So just to give the very brief background, in Northern Ireland, there was a bakery owned by Catholic bakers. Well, they were Catholics who were bakers. And two men went into the bakery and said, can you bake us this cake? Which was a cake with a picture of Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street saying, celebrate gay marriage, something like that. And the bakers said, no, it doesn't accord with our Christian belief. And they failed in their so they were a discrimination case under Northern Irish law was brought against them. And they failed up to the Court of Appeal. And then the Supreme Court reversed it and said, well, actually, what was going on here was compelled speech. What's compelled speech and how does it fit into this sort of paradigm?
So compelled speech essentially involves me telling you that you must say something that you do not believe. So in this case, it hinged really on the fact that the writing and the expression on the cake, in other words, the bakers were being asked to say something that they did not believe.
Or say something through the medium of cake.
Yes. This is a really interesting case because, again, comes back to where different laws intersect with one another. And I think, again, this is something that we often forget. So we do have the Equality Act in this country, which is the act that sets out the ways in which individuals are protected from discrimination and harassment and so on. And so on the one hand, employers are obliged to provide services, except in very certain circumstances, to everyone, regardless of gender, race, and so on. There are some very specific carve-outs, for example, for women's services, refuges, and so on. But in general, if I go into a baker, the baker ought to sell me a cake, whether or not I am gay, heterosexual, black, white, Muslim, Jewish, atheist, okay? So that is how the case was brought, essentially, to say, well, I was not served a cake because I was a gay person. But actually, in fact, and this is why it's I talk about expression, the writing part is important, or the actual expression that was being asked. But actually, the riposte to that was, it's not that we didn't want to serve you because you were a gay person, it's that we would have happily served you a cake as a gay couple, we would have sold you a cake, but we are not prepared to write and use the expression that you force us to because it is counter to our beliefs.
Yeah, and they would have done the same. They would have said the same to anybody, regardless of their sexual orientation or religion or whatever. The point was they wouldn't have baked that cake for anybody, and I think that's what that's why the Supreme Court said it's not discrimination. In that sense, it is compelled speech, which is an American concept that they've imported.
But it seems trivial, almost. You might think, well, why is everybody arguing about cake? This is ridiculous. I know we've spent a lot of time watching Bake Off and we've become a bit cake obsessed, but actually this is a trivial thing. But actually it's a really important principle on both sides. One, which is that we do have the Equality Act, which is absolutely vital. People should be protected from being discriminated against because of their sexual orientation or their religious background or their race. That's absolutely vital. It's essential that we have that in place. On the other hand, it's also essential that we have free expression protections that protect not just our ability to express ourselves, and particularly in this day and age where I think political expression is increasingly under threat, and that's something maybe we can talk about after, but also that they're not compelled to say something that they do not believe. Because if you think about it, we talked earlier about authoritarian regimes, that too is the hallmark of authoritarianism, is individuals or indeed states or groups compelling other groups to say things that they do not believe. And protecting our ability to speak our own truths is really important.
Can we talk about the press for a bit? Because I think the press have a sort of special category in this area, aren't they?
And we like to think so.
And not necessarily because they've got more protections, but they are seen as a particular, well, certainly traditionally, a location for freedom of speech. So how are the press protected?
In a number of circumstances, there are specific carve-outs for press or for journalists, for example. So in terrorism law, for example, you often find specific protections introduced that will allow journalists to access what would otherwise be considered terrorist content that other people would be prosecuted for accessing or sharing. There are carve-outs to protect journalists.
And we just had that, didn't we, with the Times
that's just been
Shamima Begum.
Yeah, so those protections, there are some specific protections that exist to protect a free press.
The police tried to get the transcripts of the interviews which a Times journalist did in Syria with Shamima Begum, who is a, I guess probably fairly described as a terrorist suspect. who went to fight with ISIS and was a very prominent case. And the court said no. The court said no, journalist source is sacrosanct. We're not, presumably this is what they said, we're not giving you the source, we're not giving you the transcripts, even though it might be important for national security.
And that largely holds, but it can be contested. So, for example, last year, two Northern Irish journalists were arrested over a documentary that they made about a massacre in 1996, I think it was, in a pub in Northern Ireland. That, and the documentary alleged collusion between the security services and the killers. Now, instead of the police then going after the people who were identified in this documentary as being responsible potentially for this killing, in fact, the two journalists were arrested and their homes and their offices raided. They were put on quite stringent bail conditions, so it was very difficult for them to travel. And it took nearly a year for that case to be overturned. And one of the important principles that I think was stressed during that case was what it is that police can reasonably demand in terms of evidence from journalists. So we have something called production orders where the police can say, we want you to give us material that we think relates to a crime being committed. But there are quite strict rules around reasonable suspicion, how much notice you're allowed to give, that I think are quite regularly, unfortunately, in the UK at the moment, being flouted. So I think it's really important that we understand why laws are crafted with particular restrictions that create a very high threshold before you can start to demand information for journalists. Because protection of journalist sources is absolutely crucial. Many of the big stories that have broken down the line that tell us important things about the way in which government is spending our money, the way in which government is using our armed forces, have come through individuals who couldn't have spoken openly because they would have almost immediately been fired or in fact been breaking the Official Secrets Act, who have gone to journalists with that information. And the protection of those sources is really key.
But there's a limit. And I think that's a... Let's talk about the limits on journalists, or put it another way, that the flip side of the journalists being protected is they have certain responsibilities and legal duties. So what are those? Where does that come to sharp focus in terms of what journalists can't do?
It comes into focus in areas such as court reporting, for example. So for very good reasons, there are all sorts of restrictions that come in the way in which we report what's happening in courts, to protect witnesses, for example, to make sure that juries can carry out their duties without undue influence from other information. So,
and that would be something like the headline in the newspaper saying halfway through a trial, guilty. He's obviously guilty. And even if they were, using their best efforts, like judges tell them to do, to avoid the press, it's quite difficult to walk past a load of headlines that say guilty.
That's exactly the kind of restriction. And as a journalist, I'm a trained journalist. One of the things that you're taught very early on is to read through your media law guide so that you know very well what are the restrictions. Unfortunately, in this country, there are very few restrictions on the press, and the restrictions that exist largely are to protect other areas, such as justice being efficiently and properly served. Sometimes journalists are unfairly restricted and would often then go back and argue, for example, their ability to report somebody's name. So that often gets contested and discussed, and the judge may find that, in fact, actually, they will allow a newspaper, for example, to report someone's name. Generally, for example, you're not allowed to report minors' names, for example, if they're involved in a crime, but judges may grant exceptional circumstances where the press might be allowed to print that name. And those things are often negotiated. But those restrictions...
They're negotiated, but by way of a sort of formal process.
By way of a formal process, yeah. In order to protect... And, freedom of expression, to me, as I've said, is the bedrock of democracy. There are other pillars that are essential to democracy, and obviously justice is one of those, and the need for the judiciary to be able to do its work effectively. And so while we don't welcome limits on the press in general, there are some restrictions that we see as being necessary for other elements of democracy to flourish effectively. It's not an unreasonable restriction, for example, to suggest that you shouldn't be publishing damaging information about an individual midway through the trial that might affect the outcome of the trial, because otherwise justice is not being properly served.
One of the issues which, again, from social media has arisen is there are now a lot more journalists, or at least there's a lot more people describing themselves as citizen journalists. So people who in the past wouldn't have had access to any kind of method of dissemination now have big platforms which they develop for no cost. And the most obvious recent example is Tommy Robinson, or Stephen Yaxley Lennon is his real name. So he describes himself as a journalist. He was standing outside of a court of a trial involving a grooming gang, a group of men who were grooming children for sexual acts, and were ultimately convicted. And he was standing outside and he said reporting, but he was convicted of contempt of court. Can you just sort of explain how that happened?
Well, because he was in contempt of court because he was reporting things that the judge, as I understand it, had said should not be reported. Reporting matters that should not have been reported. And no other journalist reported those elements.
And the judge didn't just say that, he ordered it.
Yes.
So he put it, there was a formal court order in place.
So no other journalist reported those things. And describing yourself as a journalist or as a free speech warrior or whatever is not some sort of magic protection from the law. If I, as a journalist, went to court to report on something and the court had ordered that an element shouldn't be reported, if I then did that, I would be breaking the law. Now, in very exceptional circumstances, you might argue that a journalist may decide that there are absolute huge public interest, there's huge public interest value in reporting a particular element. But in general, journalists understand that alongside journalism as a key element of democracy, the effective functioning of our court system and our justice system is also important, and therefore accept that legal restrictions on the reporting within, as I've said, quite tight limits are acceptable. Now, there are elements when that gets challenged. So other restrictions that we haven't talked about on speech include things like defamation and libel laws. So in other words, there are protections that exist in law if I defame you. If I say something about you that is untrue, either verbally or in writing, you have an opportunity to seek redress. And quite often, people in positions of power will abuse those pieces of law to try and prevent journalists reporting on their private lives or their political dealings or their business dealings. And so quite often, media organizations or journalists will find themselves in court having to argue for why they should be able to publish that information.
Yeah, why it's in the public interest.
Why it's in the public interest.
And I guess the there was a series of cases around super injunctions mostly about football, sports people having affairs that were binding to the whole world. But then those are the most recent case was about Philip Green allegedly abusing people in his organization, and his identity was restricted until the press said actually it's in the public interest not to restrict it, and they won.
And my point really is that it's not, being a journalist is not a defense against breaking the law. It's perfectly possible as a journalist to argue against restrictions on publishing because it is in the public interest, and media organizations frequently do, because, as I say, people in positions of power and authority will often try and abuse the law to prevent journalists and media outlets from publishing information that is in our public interest. But on its own, I am a media organization, I am a journalist, is not a defense on its own in law.
It goes back to principles in the end, and I suppose this brings us full circle. It's those human rights principles. You know, what is the public interest in free speech? and journalists are in the public interest zone. So if something's not in the public interest, it doesn't fall under necessarily under the protection of journalists.
And it's also why, actually, though I think there should be as few limits on free expression as possible, it's really important that those things are tested in the court of law ultimately, rather than by fiat from government or by social media mob, for example. That's where those tight questions about harm, about public interest, that's where they ought to be negotiated and debated and agreed, not in either the court of public opinion or, much worse, in sort of diktat from on high, where a state simply rules that certain kinds of content or information simply won't be allowed.
And I suppose the final example that about that restrictions on journalists that I was thinking of was Julian Assange. So this isn't about court reporting, this is about national security. So Julian Assange is currently facing extradition for to the United States for espionage, so for releasing diplomatic cables which supposedly broke the law, which allegedly caused harm to the American security services. Now, this is a talk about social media arguments. This is what was the most fiercely defended and litigated issue out there. Is Julian Assange a free speech warrior who is protecting the public interest, or is he a irresponsible charlatan who is actually damaging national security, although at the same time doing some things which are in the public interest?
I think in his particular case, and on this particular charge, which relates to encouraging another individual to share secret information, that is what journalists do all the time. Good journalists are trying to find information that other people want to keep secret, often because they want to protect their own interests. That's what good journalists do. So on those particular charges, it's really concerning that we end up in this discussion about whether Julian Assange was a good person or a bad person or a journalist or not a journalist. In my view, that's irrelevant. We should be looking at whether what...
Bad people can be good journalists.
Of course. And good journalists can be bad people. But the important thing is to look at is whether the charges that he's being pursued for relate to journalistic activity. In my view, they absolutely do. And we should be really concerned, because if he is indeed extradited and if he's indeed found guilty, then any journalist engaging in conversations with individuals who are privy to secret information that is in the public interest, and there are many elements of the work that he did that certainly meets that category, will be found guilty. And that's got to worry us as a society, because the work of journalists is to inform us of things that we need to know to be able to function as full and engaged citizens.
I mean, we could talk forever about this, because it really does highlight and bring into focus some of the most important issues out there for everybody. But we're going to wind up, and I wanted to ask you for three human rights things that have inspired you. And that can be anything from a case to a book to a film to a person to an event, but just something which is going to help people who are interested in this issue to go further.
So I would talk about three formative areas of my life. So my father is South African, so I grew up in the UK, but at a time when South Africa was obviously under an apartheid regime. And obviously for me, the experiences of Nelson Mandela and the approach of Nelson Mandela, which always looks at being able to talk to your enemy, is absolutely inspirational. The idea that you should be able to converse and sit down with your enemy has been to me absolutely key in thinking about why free expression is important, but also how you can approach negotiating with people whom you fundamentally disagree with and who've been persecuting you for a long time. So he would be the first, obviously. I also take inspiration from an oft-quoted and I think overused and something I know, Adam, you've talked about before, but the Pastor Niemöller poem, which talks about first they came for, which relates to the Holocaust, but it is really an exhortation for us to think about how we can think about others. So for me, human rights is not thinking about your own interest first. It's thinking about why it's important to put yourself in the position of other people, and never assume ultimately that you might not be that person. And I think particularly in this current climate, people increasingly thinking about that, people who thought that perhaps they would never face persecution, suddenly finding themselves in that position and why it's that's important. And then I think the third one for me, it's in top of mind actually, because this week her new book came out, The Testament. So Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale is really powerful in my life because I think it's a reminder that worlds that we think about as being fictional and far away can often end up being true in real life. And so we should always imagine the worst case scenario in order to be able to fight for the best case scenario. So as a freedom is, as I say, hard won, but easily lost. And we have to be able to imagine that it will be lost so that we continue to fight for it now.
Those are three absolutely brilliant choices. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. Jodie Ginsberg, who's the CEO of Index on Censorship. How can people find out more about Index?
Come on our website, indexoncensorship.org, and you'll find out lots of ways to engage with our work and support us.
Brilliant. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to my guest, Jodie Ginsberg from Index on Censorship. That was a really interesting discussion. Just to remind you, you can support the podcast by going to patreon.com/betterhuman, follow Be Human Podcast on Twitter, email me, adam@betterhumanpodcast.com with any comments or suggestions for future episodes. And to remind you, the podcast is supported by Goldsmiths Law and their pioneering new LLB Law undergraduate course taught in London. Goldsmiths has open days on Saturday the 5th of October and Wednesday the 6th of November, where you can meet their law academics and find out more about studying their law programme. Until next time, thanks very much. This has been the Better Human Podcast.